I'm Roger Field, work in the national offices of the American Lutheran Church. One of my assignments is as liaison between the ALC and the Commission for a New Lutheran Church. So this week I've been developing a series called Issues in the Formation of the New Lutheran Church. Today is the fifth and final one of that series, titled How Will the New Church Relate to Other Churches? Let's begin in prayer. Heavenly Father, it has always been difficult for us to move from saying that the church is one to practicing the unity of the church. Help us to understand which divisions are caused only by human sin and which in fact serve to glorify you by holding up emphases that are important. Help us to be more your church for the sake of service in your world, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. My notes today are shorter. That may not mean that what I say is shorter, but the intention is that there might be some time at the end for the kinds of questions that you wish I had addressed, but I haven't. There ought to be a chance for you to ask some of those. So I'm going to see whether I can leave some time at the end. But first, let's talk about interchurch relationships, or the technical and Greek term is ecumenism, the unity or the unifying concerns of the church. From its very beginnings in the 16th century, the evangelical reformers had to grapple with issues about whether to give such high priority to unity that they would not allow separation, or such high priority to their understanding of the truth that they could not tolerate unity if unity bridged over or papered over or denied those differences. At first, the problem for them was to decide whether what they believed and understood was worth breaking that medieval synthesis that is often called Christendom. That word I'd spend just a minute with you on. Christendom was a classic medieval word, and it had that sense that there was one church, and that that one church had a direct and dominating link. It's more than a link, a direct and a dominating role with regard to secular society. So there was the one church and there was the one Holy Roman Empire. It was not worldwide, they knew that, but on the other hand, it surely covered all of their world. The reformers had to decide whether what they had come to believe was worth shattering that medieval synthesis and fracturing the one church. Obviously, they decided it was when that one church refused to be reformed. Later on, not very many years later on, the Lutheran reformers had to decide how they felt about the other reformers, who partly because the Lutherans had succeeded, partly because it was the temper of the times, were developing reformations of their own. High on the list would be John Calvin, who started his work in France and then ends up in Geneva, Switzerland. There is King Henry VIII of England, who is an unlikely reformer with an unlikely set of motives, but nevertheless does bring about a breach with Rome. And there's correspondence between Luther and Henry and between Lutheran theologians and those of the Anglican Church. They had to decide what to do about Ulrich Zwingli, the Swiss reformer, and what we generally now talk about as the Reformed tradition. And then on the extreme left, ideologically, the Lutherans rather quickly and under great pressure had to decide what to do about a group that were, the word translates as enthusiasts, they were the Schwärmer, I suppose we might call them Pentecostals, although that's not quite fair to them, those who believed that the Spirit of God was bypassing the structures of the church and the special province of the clergy, and that in fact the right way to understand the church was that the Spirit communicates directly, immediately with all believers, and they in turn communicate the faith with each other. So very early, the young Reformed Church had to decide what on earth it was going to do about its relationship or lack of relationship with all of those groups. And at the same time, it is simply a fact of life that nearly every church, the evangelical ones that later came to be called Lutheran, certainly some of the Reformed ones led by Zwingli, and certainly the Church of England, were not what we currently understand a church to be, a collection of individuals interspersed throughout another population that is either some other church body or nothing in religious terms. They were all territorial churches. That is to say, they understood that their parish was identical with the whole population of a geographic area. Fascinating when you stand in Luther's church in Wittenberg and survey what was then the old town of Wittenberg of about 3,000 people, to be aware of the fact that Luther didn't have to wonder who his parishioners were. They were everybody in that town except the few who went to the castle church up on the hill. But his parish was the whole population of Wittenberg. And it is in that sense that the churches had to struggle with the matter of how to relate to each other. Not until this country, not until the American experience, have churches generally had to deal with the business of having their membership interspersed with membership of a half dozen or who knows how many other denominations. That is a uniquely American experience. Well, the Lutherans, I call them Lutherans, but you know they didn't use that title till after Luther's death, but what we know as the Lutherans had to make up their minds what they were going to say and do about relationships to others. And here's the way they put it in Article 7 of the Augsburg Confession, which is probably is certainly their earliest and probably their best statement about interchurch or what we call interdenominational relationships. Article 7. It is also taught among us that one holy Christian church will be and remain forever. This is the assembly of all believers, among whom the gospel is preached in its purity, and the holy sacraments are administered according to the gospel. And then this language, for it is sufficient for the true unity of the Christian church that the gospel be preached in conformity with a pure understanding of it, and that the sacraments be administered in accordance with the divine word. It is not necessary for the true unity of the Christian church that ceremonies instituted by men should be observed uniformly in all places. And then it quotes approvingly from Paul in Ephesians 4, there is one body and one spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism. Article 7 of the Augsburg Confession. It was offered by Lutherans at a time when they frankly were willing to coexist with Roman Catholic dioceses and Roman Catholic structures, if only there could be a cessation of the verbal war and the threat of physical war over religious issues. They offered it, in other words, in a pacific, in a peaceful kind of gesture that was not well received by the Roman Church, and therefore it did not accomplish its immediate purposes. It didn't solve a great deal at the time, but it did stake out a posture. It did declare how this young new church felt about other churches. The issue tended to kind of fester in the European setting in the years after that. Did not become, again, a really large issue until the approach of the 300th anniversary of the posting of the 95 Theses. And then in 1817, the King of Prussia, in a bid to try to cut, I suppose that's not fair to him, but I'll go ahead and say it anyway, in a bid to try to cut the number of territorial churches from 3 to 2, suggested, well, it's more than that, it was a royal decree, decreed that Lutheran and Reformed communions ought to merge into a so-called Union Church or the Prussian Union, and then there would be only 2 churches, Catholic and Evangelical, or whatever they were going to call that Prussian Union, and for Prussia that really meant there was only one, because it was all on the Reformed side. Or all on the Protestant side, I ought to say. The Prussian Union proposal suddenly just created an uproar. It was supposed to be a joyous celebration of the 300th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. It was instead the beginning of a long, hard hassle that in some ways still affects Lutherans, both in that country and in this one. There are a number of evangelical territorial churches in Germany. There are a number of union churches in Germany. And in the area of the union churches, there are a number of free churches that are Lutherans who refuse to be part of the union church. And it happens that one of those free churches is the one that sent the Saxons that settled in and around St. Louis and became the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, a church that objected to unionism. Do you hear the Prussian Union unionism language? They weren't the only ones who objected. Most Lutherans objected to being thrown in with the Zwinglians, the Reformed, and they objected primarily, their public objection at least, was primarily that the Reformed did not believe in the real presence of Christ in the sacrament. They believed in a representational or memorial sense of Jesus' presence. That became the focal point of the hassle. Well, at any rate, the Prussian Union bequeathed to those Germans who came to this country after 1817 a history of the fear of being coerced into common structures with other Christians. Now, those Germans who had gotten here earlier, the Pennsylvania Dutch, the ones who are now the East Coast portion of the Lutheran Church in America, they are relatively unaffected by it because they came before it was an issue. And as Germans came and joined their churches after it was an issue, they at least could not dominate. And so the older, more relaxed attitude on interchurch relationships characterizes the dominant current LCA attitude. Now, please don't misunderstand relaxed. I don't use that the way Missouri uses it to describe the LCA, as meaning that you don't stand for much. Relaxed means you don't feel as threatened by it because your core of historic experience does not include the attempt of the King of Prussia to force you into union. So you who are of the LCA background have a core of understanding that Christian reunion is a voluntary thing, not a coerced one. But for all the Germans who came after 1817, there was ringing in their heads this Prussian Union business, and Prussia by then is much larger than just one province. It is becoming a larger and larger dominating factor on the German scene. Unionism is an issue. My suspicion is it would have been an issue anyway, because the American frontier tended to thrive on denominational particularity. It was simply a part of the frontier experience that people in a search for identity at a time when so many things were up for grabs, one of the identities they tried to nail down was a set of doctrines and a set of religious practices that were just tailor-made by them for them. And the business, the thought that they ought to find commonality with other people of different language backgrounds and cultural backgrounds and with differing confessions or no confession at all, that just never appealed to any of the groups on the frontier or practically with none of them. So there was a kind of a defensiveness, a kind of denominational particularity that I suspect would have made the frontier a separatistic kind of place even if the Prussian Union hadn't been an issue. For Lutherans, though, the Prussian Union was an issue. So was the question of whether, in fact, other Protestants in America were doctrinally impure, or to use Missouri's famous phrase, whether they were heterodox, meaning believing in a lot of doxes, a lot of different kinds of understandings. Lutherans, under that kind of pressure, decided they had to make some judgment about interrelationship, transfer of members, intercommunion, and willingness or unwillingness to listen to each other's clergy. The result was a meeting in 1872 in Akron, Ohio, followed by a meeting in 1875 in Galesburg, Illinois, and what results is normally called the Galesburg Rule. I I'm going to lift it out in the form that the General Synod adopted it. The General Synod is one of the antecedents of the Lutheran Church in America, but it represents a broader group than that. They first let me read it the way it was adopted, then read an read what was ruled to be an amendment, and I'll read it a second time with that amendment. Here's the way it was originally adopted. The rule is Lutheran pulpits are for Lutheran ministers only. Lutheran altars are for Lutheran communicants only. That's number one. Number two, the exceptions to the rule belong in the sphere of privilege, not right. And number three, the determination of the exceptions is to be made in consonance with these principles by the conscientious judgment of pastors as the cases arise. Let me unpack it, then read the amendment, then read the rule again. Clearly the first intention was to simply say Lutherans ought to stick to their own churches, they ought to commune only with each other, they ought to listen only to Lutheran clergy, others are simply not welcome, and the debate that preceded this simply highlighted that language out of 1 Corinthians 11 that says whoever eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks damnation. And they early came to a judgment that the body referred to in that 1 Corinthians 11 passage means the body of Jesus, the real presence, to use Lutheran language. It is only very recently that we've come to take another look at that and say that there is a very real possibility, a very risky possibility, that the discerning of the body that's talked about there is the body of believers, and there is a presumption that it's the body of Christ. That's a whole other question that we may want to come to later in the hour. The second part of that rule, then, simply said, are we going to allow any exceptions at all? The answer was yes, but nobody can claim the right to such an exception. The exception will be a privilege that can be extended by the church, but it can't be claimed by an individual. And the third was, then who makes the exception? The answer was parish pastors do. Now, the amendment that came at Galesburg in 1875 was to make this sound less arbitrary by anchoring it to the scriptures and the Lutheran confessions. So they wrote this introductory phrase. It's hard to realize at this stage how much they fought over this little bit of language, but listen to it. The rule which accords with the Word of God and with the confessions of our church is Lutheran pulpits are for Lutheran ministers only, Lutheran altars are for Lutheran communicants only, the exceptions to the rule belong in the sphere of privilege, not of right, the determination of the exceptions is to be made in consonance with these principles by the conscientious judgment of pastors as the cases arise. So the Galesburg rule. I'll give you a chance to ask questions about it in just a bit, but let me say a couple more things first. The Galesburg rule, first of all, created an all or nothing pattern of interchurch fellowship. Either there had to be agreement sufficient to be able to exchange, to commune each other, to listen to each other's clergy, to transfer members, to transfer clergy, either the whole business or nothing. It really became one of the litmus tests of real Lutherans versus those Lutherans who grew too American and therefore too liberal. Now, the therefore I stick in there is deliberate, because that was the kind of mentality that was building up, was that the danger in becoming Americanized and adopting the English language was that in the process you would then be able to carry on too much conversation and theological speculation with heterodox, with other kinds of people who claim to be Christian. I stuck the word claim to be in there too, because at that point there was starting to be a question about whether those others really were even Christian or not. The public pious reasons for this exclusiveness about pulpit and altar fellowship was the need to protect true believers from heresy and protect heretics from eating and drinking their own damnation by communing with us. The not so public reason would also seem to be that by now, especially Germans, for whatever reasons, had come to believe that it was important to keep their own ethnic and linguistic purity in order to keep the faith pure. They really felt that one of the ways to safeguard the faithful was to keep them talking German and worshiping in German. To that end, they, not just the Missouri Synod, the Iowa Synod, the Joint Synod of Ohio, the Wartburg and Nebraska Synods of what is now the LCA, the Wisconsin Synod, which was at that time three different synods, Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, all of them held on to this business that you needed to keep the ethnic ties in order to keep the faith pure. And what they did particularly was to try to anchor the German language in their worship, their publications, their parochial schools, which had to be taught in German, and their seminaries, where theological instruction had to happen in German. They'd like to have anchored their college systems too, but the colleges needed students, and the students were getting an education in order to get ahead in a very business-oriented America. So the colleges were among the earliest to shift to English, and the church bodies and the seminaries and the parochial schools were among the latest. That's just a piece of history. Hard to say how long that would have lasted, except that when America went to war on Good Friday, 1917, against the Germans, the wave of anti-German sentiment quickly resulted in the closing of a lot of parochial schools, the insistence on the use of English language in others, book burnings and some tar and featherings and some floggings and just a wave of anti-German sentiment that put the German churches on the defensive and forced them to prove how American they were, including greater willingness to use the language. German use of German didn't end by any means with that, but it certainly took a fatal long-term blow. A couple of other things, and then it's your turn. The original Article 7 of Augsburg Confession was meant to say how Lutherans would relate to Reformed enthusiasts, even the Roman Catholics. It shouldn't surprise you that on the American frontier, Lutherans started to use it to decide which Lutherans could relate to which other Lutherans. A use never intended by the Augsburg Confession. And not surprisingly, those who wanted exclusiveness decided that the Augsburg Confession statement was much too, they said, brief. What they really meant was too liberal. And so they turned to a section out of the Formula of Concord instead and learned to love the phrase, agreement in the gospel and all its articles, or the gospel according to all its articles. And it wasn't long before they were able to make practically every piece of Christian doctrine an article of the gospel, and therefore to require agreement in all those details before there could be intercommunion and other evidences of fellowship. I want to give you a chance to ask questions at that point, because while that's history that's over 100 years old, it is also very current.
Interjection.
Yeah.
I went to Dave Messenbrenner's.
Yes.
First night, Monday night, and he was introducing what he was doing in his sojourn in South Africa, and he was saying that, I'm not sure I understood what he said to me, or understood what he was trying to say to me, but he said that the official position of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod when he was sent to South Africa was that for him to convert the heathen, or for any missionary to convert the heathen down there, what they classified the heathen was that, first of all, they had to learn the only language that God understood, and that was German.
Yes. Missouri would never have allowed itself to get caught saying that's the only language God understood.
Well, that's what they said.
Yes. But it is true that they felt they could only teach real theology in German. And therefore, the training of pastors, they never required the lay people to learn German. They required that the pastors learn it the future pastors, as a study language. And the seminary that I went to in the 50s still remembered its last great champion of German language, Michael Roy, who'd been dead 12 years but was still teaching there by way of his writings and stuff. all translated into English, but people remembered. My father-in-law, who went there in the World War I era, said, Dr. Roy allowed that certain practical courses could be taught in English, but all the real theological courses you taught in German, because you just couldn't translate all that stuff.
But he also said that down there they couldn't be baptized unless they learned German.
Yes. I don't know if that's true.
That's what he said. That's what I've heard anyway.
My guess is that you could find mission fields related to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod where that was true. You know that we have several kinds of mission fields. We have the kind that American churches started, and that's likely to be the kind he's talking about. We have the other kind, and that is German mission fields that had to be taken over during World War I, and in many cases then the mandate passed to somebody on the Allied side, and the Germans couldn't go back to their fields. And that would be different, because the Germans tended not to be as touchy about that. But I'm not surprised. Missouri's own mission fields are in strong revolt against the Synod at this point, and would be in stronger revolt except that they're dependent for finances and missionaries. We've had any number of Missouri missionaries who have come to the American Lutheran Church in order to go back into world mission activity. And one whole synod, the Central American one, is watching our union process very closely in the hope that there may be a place for them in it.
I remember as a boy, I couldn't understand how God could hear a prayer unless it said in Swedish.
Yeah. Hager the Horrible says, we ought to all have one language, but I don't know if we can find enough Norwegians to teach them. Anything else on what has clearly been an American aberration on this pulpit and altar fellowship? I call it an aberration. Ooh. Okay, the question is the new theological statement going to say anything different about the real presence? No. There's no difference of opinion among us on that matter. And none between us and Missouri on that matter. The difference of opinion is whether or not you can admit people of other denominations to commune with you. But there's no theological difference between us at that point. When I come to describe the Episcopal action a little bit later this hour, then that gets to be an interesting question. No, there'll be nothing new proposed there. We understand ourselves to have a common Eucharistic theology, as evidenced by the LCA and ALC's development of a common statement on communion practices. And I'm sure AELC would have been party to the development and approval of a statement like that, except that AELC didn't exist when we started that process. And it had a 4-year gestation period, so by the time it was done, AELC did exist. Yes?
Isn't this rather checkered history that we have of which causes us indeed some shame and desire to repent, so to speak.
Yeah.
Isn't it reflective of the problem the Lutheran tradition has had with vocabulary?
Yes.
And understanding of self from the very Reformation time?
Yes.
I have a problem, and you may be speaking to this, but I have a problem with the term New Church. For I don't see how that fits theologically with the ecclesia, the biblical idea of the church.
Sure.
And how we can have church officials and leaders being almost dogmatic that we refer to this as a new church coming out, as opposed to a merged church, which the ALC and LCA went through in the 1960s. And pursuing that thought, how does that then relate? Isn't it rather presumptuous of ourselves to talk about a new church when we're dealing with the Episcopal tradition, the Methodist tradition, all of those which are a part of the Catholic Church, along with ourselves? Could you speak to that? Could you clarify that?
Yeah.
I do struggle with that.
As you suggest, the theological shorthand tends to become a problem, or language used in this case in the ecclesiological sense, becomes a problem. What we really mean is a new expression of the church, not a new church. And we really mean a new expression rather than a conservative kind of merger of existing structures. And Monday I tried to address some of that by saying, how new is the new church going to be? And there are ways it's going to be new and other ways in which no amount of linguistics will protect us from the fact that we are coalescing very similar traditions. I'll say a little more after a bit. Let me go on and add a little bit now. For Lutherans, pulpit and altar fellowship, who preaches to and listens together and who confesses together and who communes together, that was crucial, that was central. The possibility of working together with other Christians in agencies, that wasn't quite so touchy. And during World War I, particularly, when the war fell upon us and the federal government decided to deal with the chaplaincy needs of men in service by asking the YMCA to take it all over, you can imagine what Lutherans thought of that. And so did a number of other denominations rise up in arms, and the government then in turn said, well, you know, propose a way so that we don't have to deal with 200 different denominations. And specifically what the government said to Lutherans was, if there's one Lutheran body, we might be willing to deal with you, but if you're going to come at us as 16 or 20 or something like that, forget it. Under that kind of pressure, the Lutherans did form a Soldiers and Sailors Ministry Commission, that's close to the right title anyway, and quickly called chaplains and worked with the whole matter of serving people in impacted areas, that kind of thing, discovered that they needed to be able to work together with relief concerns at the end of the war, and created the National Lutheran Council, which Missouri and Wisconsin Synod are not a part of, but the rest are, were, and created an organization that really brought about an era of cooperation that might not have happened except for the war. And then with cooperation, the discovery that we were not nearly as different from each other as leading theologians had suggested we were. That's background. What I need to say now, what I want to say now, is to talk about the search the new church is going to have for the right kind of ecumenical posture. First of all, it's clear that we have a lowering of our defensiveness, that we have become more willing as churches to take our chances on relationships with those who disagree with us. I personally need to say it stronger than that. I have come to be convinced that it is arrogant and untimely to argue that we have the truth and that anybody who disagrees with us is that much away from the truth. I think we are historically conditioned. I think we carry answers to the scriptures as well as questions. I fervently hope that we have been right in unlocking Christ and the cross as the center of the scriptures, and that we have been right in holding up as cardinal doctrine the matter of justification by grace through faith. But I am not able personally to use that as a way of saying, since we are right, that makes the rest of you wrong. I think we have been guilty of finding way too many answers and locking them in as the only answers, more out of our need for certainty than out of any legitimate certainty. So there's a lowering of our defensiveness and a willingness to recognize that the invisible church, that's language Lutherans have loved, the invisible church in which there are believers from all over, actually has a lot more visible expressions than we've been willing to grant. Thus it is a foregone conclusion for the three united churches that we will not back away from our present commitments. And our present three church commitments include the Lutheran World Federation, where we link with almost 100 Lutheran churches around the world, and with the World Council of Churches, where we link with almost 300 churches around the world. And that's where I come back to the word you raised earlier, the word Catholic, used in its right sense, small letter C, the Church Catholic, meaning the Church Universal. We are surely not going to back away. It is not clear to me yet whether the new church will have to take a formal action declaring itself a member of those two organizations, or whether the present membership of all three churches will simply build that right into our founding documents. I don't know that detail. What I know is I don't hear dominant groups in the churches suggesting any backing away. Those who objected to the old ELCs joining the World Council in the first place back in 1956 still object, by and large, and will use that as a rallying point, so I expect there will be some fireworks about this. But there is no thought on the part of the churches of backing away from our ecumenical commitments to the rest of Christendom. Again, after a bit, I'll lay this open to question. A second kind of thing that's been going on that makes this a different time for us is that we have been engaged both nationally and internationally in a number of what are called bilateral dialogues. That is to say, Lutherans and Roman Catholics, both nationally and internationally. Lutherans and Orthodox internationally, and we're trying to get the national one going now. Lutherans and Methodists in this country. Lutherans and the Reformed tradition, both worldwide and in this country. Lutherans and Episcopalians in this country, Lutherans and Anglicans worldwide. In this country, we've even had conversations with the conservative element in, you can't say with the conservative churches, that wouldn't be fair, but a dialogue team drawn from five seminaries that serve some of the evangelical church bodies have been in some dialogue with us, and we've had Lutheran Baptist conversations nationally. All of these have suggested to us that we used to commit a basic error when we told ourselves what other groups believed instead of asking them what they believed, and that it's time to correct the error by asking people to say what it is they believe, and then being aware of the fact that it is possible to use relatively different language to mean relatively the same things, and that we ought to look at what they mean, not whether they use our language to get it said. Lutherans, in their traditional understanding of dialogue, they didn't use the word dialogue, we used the term open conference. Those tended to be situations where you brought your agenda and read it, and if anybody was willing to buy the whole thing, then you declared yourself to be in fellowship. The dialogues have not operated that way. We have had to learn to appreciate somebody else's language and tradition, and yet not to simply sacrifice key doctrinal concerns. Well, the first place this... I should give you a chance to get at this before I talk about the Lutheran Episcopal one, but let me say one more thing. Certainly, historians will say that a catalytic contribution to this whole thing was Vatican II, and particularly the ecumenical understanding of Pope John XXIII. It is a little nicety of language that tends to be lost on those American Protestants who are anti-Catholic, but it is a fact that in the last 20 years, the Roman Church has gone from thinking about us as heretics to thinking about us as separated brethren. And that's really a very significant kind of shift. Let me give you a chance to ask questions generally, then I'll talk about Lutheran Episcopal and Lutheran Reformed as very specific things, and then about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'll see where we go. Larry.
What status is anticipated for the relationship to the National Council of Churches, given LCA membership and
yeah.
LCA non-membership?
If you don't mind my holding that a minute, I'd like to put that under a heading called Issues That Will Be Difficult to Resolve.
Fine.
It's coming up. Some more.
On these dialogue teams, are they always theologians, seminary-type people, or do they involve a feeling that comes from our history, mm-hmm. that it has been the theologians who've told us what we are to believe?
Yes.
And we have had this... altar, pulpit, separation, you know, that which Luther did not conceive of, I don't think, in the priesthood of all believers. But are there any of these teams that involve the people of the pew?
There are teams that involve parish pastors, but I know of none that involve non-theologically trained lay people. I suppose, technically, you could say George Lindbeck is a lay person. But you know, he knows more theology than any of our theology professors, I suspect. He's been active in the Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue. Generally not rank and file people from the pew, but at least parish clergy, and at least not just seminary professors. And that trend has been a healthy one. It's been interesting to see that two of the leaders in the Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue have been George Lindbeck, who is Lutheran but not clergy, and Avery Dulles, who started out as a Presbyterian and is now a Jesuit. Fascinating to see these two as kind of the heavies in that dialogue.
Is the point or the goal of this dialogue fellowship, pulpit and altar fellowship, or is there a further... They're not thinking in terms of merger.
That's fascinating. That's a question I was going to come to, but it's all right now. What's the goal of the dialogues? At a minimum, the goal of the dialogues is to stop the various expressions of the body of Christ from competing with and being publicly destructive of each other. At a minimum, it's that. It has quickly become evident that we have a lot more in common than we had been led to believe. And so one suspects that it's at this point we are in fact searching for fellowship expressions. And that's where the Lutheran Episcopal one will be an interesting case study. I don't hear very many people wistfully hoping for mergers across normal denominational lines. That could come. I don't happen to be one of those who thinks that that's worth the energy to do it. I think we're better off to develop a thorough sense of collegiality, but that the process of developing enough consensus about both doctrine and structure in order to merge is a process far more expensive than we can afford.
I have a feeling that people who work together in the marketplace have that feeling already.
Oh, yes.
And that it's the institutions that are behind. We have had Eucharistic celebrations with Roman Catholics, and that comes out of the people's desire more so than the institution. At the institution, it seems to me, is fretfully trying to catch up with where the Spirit has led the people.
Yes, but let me qualify that. You're right about institution. But up until, up until World War II.
I think it could be argued that the single greatest barrier to interconfessional relationships was the way seminarians were taught. That seminaries were the places where exclusiveness was kind of bred in. And one of the revolutions that has gone kind of unnoticed is that the seminaries have just flip-flopped on that and are now way out in front. We have seminaries who are in consortia, we have joint catalogs, cross-registration, we have non-Lutherans on teaching faculties in our seminaries, and we have Lutherans on their faculties. Seminaries jumped from being the keepers of that segregationist or separationist sentiment to being the ones who are kind of pulling everything along with them, for better or worse, but at least the change is very real. Let me do the Lutheran Episcopal one as an illustration. The three uniting churches of ALC, LCA, and AELC, at the same convention at which we voted to join in forming a new church, also voted, along with the Episcopal Church in the United States, to enter into a relationship that is described as interim Eucharistic sharing. Now let me back up a little bit. What happens is that while we've been involved in a number of dialogues dating clear back to the beginning of the Lutheran Council in 1967, dialogues, incidentally, that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has also been involved in all cases, it happens that this is the first time that a dialogue in its report at the end of its dialogue process has challenged the church to do something besides saying, gee, isn't that interesting? The Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue 1, which ended in the early 1970s, did make a recommendation, but it didn't make it forcefully enough, and the church has managed to ignore that. irritated, that's a mild word for how they felt, irritated by that, the participants in that first dialogue, when they were appointed to do a follow-up one, determined they weren't going to let that happen again. And so out of what is called LED 2, Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue 2, came with a series of recommendations. And suddenly churches were faced with doing, all of our churches were faced with doing something we'd never done before. And that was to consider official fellowship relationship with churches outside of our normal communion pattern. The fact is we ended up taking four concurrent, identical actions, our three churches and the Episcopal Church. It just happened that they were also meeting at the same time in New Orleans, so these actions were even being taken at the same time, relatively. We, on the Lutheran side, came to an ecumenical understanding of Article 7. That is to say, when we came to the phrase, "For it is sufficient for the true unity of the Christian Church that the gospel be preached in conformity with a pure understanding of it, and that the sacraments be administered in accordance with the divine word," but when we came to that in relation to our dialogue with the Episcopalians, we came to the conclusion that they were in fact a church in which, and this is the language, we recognized each other as churches in which the gospel is preached. Having made that judgment, the question pressed itself that said, is there then any reason why we ought not in some way to symbolize that? And the dialogue said we ought to symbolize it. And then the question was, how shall we symbolize it? And the answer was, since we have more agreement on the Eucharist than we do on some other things, let us symbolize it there. And we ended up declaring a relationship that is called interim Eucharistic sharing. Term is chosen because it has no prior currency in any of the four churches. And that's what you sometimes have to do. Pick language nobody's used that way before in order to say it. And we are now clear up to here in interim Eucharistic sharing with the Episcopalians. We have also started, for the sake of the tape, what I did was put my hand way up high to say we're in it very deep. We are also in October, going to be, or December, I guess it is, beginning the third and I think the final round of Lutheran Episcopal dialogue, where we're going to tackle what is really the thorny question between us, and that is what some would call episcopal succession. Others would say the issue really is, do we recognize the marks of the apostolic church in each other, and how are we going to deal with the necessity of bishops? Lutherans say it's nice to have them, and the Episcopalians say you got to have them. That range of questions about the so-called ordering of ministry is at issue in the third round. I would guess that the new church will be asked to affirm the decision of the three uniting churches to continue this interim Eucharistic fellowship with the Episcopal Church, pending the report back to our convention somewhere around 1990 from Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue Number 3. It happens that we have a similar set of recommendations coming down the pike now from the second round of the Lutheran Reformed Dialogue. You've not seen that in print yet, but we've gotten advanced signals from the dialogue that says we're ready to report. We're going to recommend the same thing the Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue recommended, with one important exception, and that's that we're also going to suggest that we ought to be able to interchange clergy because we have no differences with regard to the ordering of ministry. And that, by any other title, is full pulpit and altar fellowship. At first we got alarmed about it because the United Church of Christ has been part of that, and that is a non-confessional church. And we wondered how on earth do confessional churches and non-confessional ones deal with that sort of declaration. But it turns out the UCC is excluding itself from that, recognizing that that's an anomaly for it as well. And so what we'll be dealing with is the merging Presbyterian Church, the reunion of the United Presbyterian and the Southern Church. That church and ours will be facing within the next couple of years the question of what would traditionally be called the Declaration of Pulpit and Altar Fellowship, but it'll be called something else. I'm not sure of the language yet. So we have two of those kinds of things going on right now. Let me give you a chance now to ask questions or make comments about that. And then we'll talk about the emerging postures. Larry.
Well, are those dialogues only involved with the two Presbyterian churches in America, or
no,
with, say, the Reformed Church in America?
It was with a five-church consortium. The two Presbyterian ones that are merging, the Cumberland Presbyterian, which is a smaller and more conservative body, the Reformed Church in America, and the UCC. Of those, the Reformed Church in America is considering sharing in a public declaration of fellowship, but has its own problems in dealing with that out of its conservative background. The Cumberland Church is not considering it because of its conservatism, and the UCC is not considering it because of its non-confessional status. So that leaves us with, for sure, the emerging Presbyterian Church and maybe the Reformed Church in America.
What about the Baptists?
Our dialogues with the Baptists have really simply highlighted how different we are from each other, and have not led to any kinds of recommendations. We are at the gee isn't that interesting stage with the Baptists. Except that, and that's where it gets very sticky, the World Council of Churches document, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, tries to bridge that by arguing that there ought to be room in the one church, the Church Catholic, for both believers' baptism and infant baptism, and does so by arguing that those who practice infant baptism ought to pay more attention to sharing the faith and encouraging those who are baptized to later affirm that baptism, what we have traditionally called confirmation. And they press that issue not in relation to American churches, where we've been pretty strong about that anyway, but in relation to those state churches in Europe where baptism has not always been followed up by any kind of formal decision by the individual to be part of a church. I wouldn't want to hazard a guess what we're going to do with that section, but it is a neat bit of footwork to put believers' baptism and infant baptism into the same section and argue that there's no essential conflict.
Wasn't that Bill Lazarus?
Bill Lazarus was the secretary for the Faith and Order Commission when the document was written.
And he has a strong voice in LCA policy and direction.
And he has a very strong voice in the Commission for New Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Which maybe then says to us as a group, you know, some of the places we may be going.
Yes.
Next decade.
And if that's the case, they are places we would have been going anyway, whether we were forming a new church or not. We are now really describing trends that we're just going to kind of carry with us into that new church. I have some reservations about this document, as you probably have guessed. I think it attempts to do too much too fast. My own preference would be that we affirm the Eucharistic section, which I think is the best section in it. I think there are reasons to argue that the Lord's Supper ought to be what unites us, not the place where we are the most separate. I have some real problems with the way that... Yes. I have some real problems with the baptismal section, but even more in the last section on ministry. I think that needs a lot of work yet.
And how has the real presence question been dealt with in Lutheran Reform?
Okay, first let me back up and say in the Episcopal discussion, we simply took their word for it, that their language does mean real presence, and their admission that there are some among them who don't believe that. We had to admit that there were some among us who don't believe what we teach. With the Reformed, if we can take the dialogue partners seriously, and I think we can, I think our experience with Presbyterians is that they mean what they say and say what they mean, they do no longer subscribe to Calvin's understanding of memorial. They do, in fact, believe in the real presence. That's what they said. That's what the report is going to say. They are reporting to us that their theology is a theology of real presence. They will not use that phrase so much as they will say that Christ is truly present in the sacrament and not simply in a memorial sense or not simply created by the faith of the believer. Now, I taught in a consortium that included a Presbyterian seminary, and I must simply say that my Presbyterian counterparts taught that way to their own students. So I think they are not just offering us what we want to hear. They have, in fact, not bought Calvin at that point. I think they were, and I also think Fred Moiser at our convention right after that said, I don't know if you realize it, but the chances are that the action we just now took toward the Episcopal Church is more far-reaching in its implications than the one we took to join in forming a new Lutheran church.
And why, do you think?
Because for the first time, Lutherans are risking practicing our sense that the church is greater than ourselves, rather than just saying it, but always casting it as an invisible church.
Does it also not say that we have finally living out our credo statement?
I think it does.
And
I think it does.
I find that strangely ironic and perplexing. That we have been a confessional church since 1530, has taken us this long to finally do that implication, to affirm the fact that the creed says we are the Church Catholic.
Yeah.
Oh.
In fairness, though, you have to say that the argument in the 1560s between the Philippists, the followers of Melanchthon, and those who tried to read the early Luther, that was not a wasted argument. Melanchthon was, in fact, too willing to compromise. What we've done instead is to wait each other out until we've gotten beyond a preoccupation with doctrine enough to do fresh biblical study. When you ask Presbyterians why they say it differently than Calvin, they say because that's what the scriptures say to us. It's biblical study. We are proposing to the Roman Catholic hierarchy in this country that we celebrate the fruits of Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue by an occasional public joint service of the word. We're saying, let's not talk about interim Eucharist. If there's any place where Lutherans and Roman Catholics don't agree yet, it's on the Lord's Supper. But have we not together studied the scriptures in fresh and exciting ways? Should we therefore not have services of the word to celebrate that common discovery? I think that'll happen.
Excuse me.
I promised Larry that I was going to get to a question, and I see that the clock pushes me, so let me do that. Issues that will be difficult to resolve, and that means that you'll have to hear about it later because we don't know where we're going yet. One you've already raised. Is it our goal with other communions to develop full fellowship or organic unity? I've already responded to that. But secondly, and that's the one Larry raised, what about the National Council? I don't know. I think that I think it's the kind of question that we will buck to the new church to decide, and simply propose a posture for the new church, and that is that it ought not to be afraid of inter-denominational work, as long as an agency doesn't try to act like a church. And the problem with the National Council in its early years was that it took on churchly function. It started to speak for the churches, and the churches didn't need to be spoken for. I think the National Council has largely backed off from that and is not near as much of a violator of that anymore. But I confess that I'm still glad the ALC is not part of the National Council, especially this last year when they're dealing with that thorny question of the whether to admit the metropolitan churches, the essentially homosexual church. A very tough question. My guess is that what we really need in this country is a broader organization of churches that tries to do less, but does it in the name of more. And that toward that end, it may well be that we'll end up with more of a federation, a coalition, that's the right kind of language, that would include Roman Catholics and Southern Baptists and Evangelicals, and that would see as its focus dealing with national and international welfare and assistance programs and disaster relief and things like that, and deal with problems between church and state in this country, rather than the present NCC. But if the NCC were to go out of business, then the small churches among its 30 members, who look to it for a great deal of staff services, will have to find some other way to be served. So I don't know. I think we'll duck the question until the new church is organized. One of the tough ones is how, if at all, is the new church going to relate to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? We have just approved, all of us, including Missouri Synod, a planning process that will bring to our 1986 General Convention a proposal for future inter-Lutheran cooperation once our new church has been formed. The Missouri Synod would like to see that new form be a Lutheran council-like structure, but with less functions and more members. They would like to see synodical conference partner churches brought in, like Wisconsin Synod. And Wisconsin has signaled that under certain circumstances it would be interested in that. Some of us who have worked with Missouri a while tend to think that it would be better not to have an agency between us. That we get better quality work together when we do direct, bilateral, project-by-project things than when we have an agency. Because, and I might as well say it the way I think it, Missouri is always terribly nervous about anything it doesn't fully control. And because of the danger that it's going to go in a direction they don't want it to go. I think that project-by-project, bilateral work could be very enriching. We have an example already. Jan helped me with what Triple C Pickle stands for. The Coordinating Committee for Congregational Resources and something. PKL.
Yeah.
Yeah. At any rate, it is an ongoing, direct link between publishing houses and life and mission units of all of the four big churches in the Lutheran Council, including Missouri Synod, has some really good products from it. Missouri has been very committed to it, has been very active in it, and there are things like that we can do together, immigration refugee services, things we can do together. It isn't all or nothing. I think it's the question, how best do we relate when Missouri is very critical of some of the things we're doing, and we have some problems with some of what they're doing. So that has to be dealt with. Huh, I had promised you time, and we didn't. Any quick questions on this or things not related? And then if you want to talk about things that spill over, we can talk at mealtime or catch me or something. Anybody? Questions? Comments? It's been an interesting week. Thank you. I hope it's been useful.